Well, good afternoon, everyone, and good afternoon to all the guests who are with us today. We appreciate you being here. I've been asked to speak for 10 minutes, which for those who know me is going to be an impossible task. So I say good afternoon and I walk off. As the introduction said, I'm a minister of the church, and one of my first ministerial assignments was in Ireland, or the Republic of Ireland. It was fascinating for me to go back to where my family roots do come from. And even if you look at Australia, one of the major societal strengths of the country has been, and part of the heritage, has been the Irish heritage. We Irish almost got rid of the English, but we didn't quite succeed. My great-grandmother was born in the Eureka Stockade with the guns hidden under her bed. So that gives you a bit of an idea of the background here. I clearly remember when I was in that assignment visiting a man in County Cork, and he was somewhat of a self-styled scholar, and we went back to he lived in a little granny flat at the back of his mother's place, and he would have been in his late 40s. I thought he was quite mature of age then, but seems quite young now. And he was surrounded in this little pad. I call it a pad, with a bed, surrounded by books and old dusty books and books that he must have found all over Ireland and had studied and read. And he had very little background to what we're going to be covering in the lectures and that what Dr. Rick Sherrod's going to be covering. And he turned to us, there's two of us there, and he said, and I won't put an Irish accent on, he said, "Would I be correct in saying that the ancient tribe of Dan is found in Ireland?" And I said, "Why would you say that?" I actually felt possibly the same thing, but I wanted to know why he felt that. And he said, "Well, I've done a lot of study into very ancient books, books that some people can't even find today, and I have come to that conclusion." And I let him know that I'd actually agreed with him. At the same time, we ran a series of Bible lectures in Dublin, and a very stately man attended, had a very great air about him, and he carried this very large stick with a prominent sculptures on the stick. And the little I talked to him and others explained to me who he was, this man believed that he was of the Royal House of Ireland. And he said in the small talks I had, because he was a little bit above talking to someone like me, because he really had that stately air about him, he said that he believed that he was related through history back to King David himself. Now, I wasn't going to get into a discussion, and I wasn't going to refute him. I just found it very fascinating and very interesting to talk to this man who came to these lectures. Now, in this very short introduction I'm giving today, that's all it is, and I'm not going to go and prove all the information I just gave you. I don't have time. We're on a very tight schedule here. I want to look at one simple prophecy, a future understanding of Dan, who is part of the tribes of Israel. All I'm going to do is whet your appetite. I know I'm not proving an awful lot because I don't have the time, but I just want to give you just whet your appetite. I'll just read a few scriptures. I can't help myself because I am a minister of the church. In Genesis 49, we read an interesting story. Jacob called unto him his sons, and he said, "Gather yourselves together, but I want to tell you something. I want to tell you that which will befall you in the last days." Now, for those who are not strong students of biblical prophecy, let me say, when you see a little flag pop up like that in the Bible, it's a little flag that just sort of flips up out of the pages, you're seeing a statement for the future, for the last days. Not then, but you're talking about the last days prior to the very establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth. So that is the basic key. Now, in these blessings he gives each one of the children, is a twofold aspect to the blessing he gives. One aspect of the blessing of Genesis 49 is a testament. It's a testament to their character. It's a testament to the characteristics of that tribe of Israel. And the second aspect of that is a prophetic aspect of the very future of that tribe. So you have this twofold aspect to it. Now in the story, as he gives each tribe a special blessing, a special testament to their characteristic, we go down to verse 16 where we read, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Now it's an interesting Hebrew play on words here, because for those who do know, the name Dan means judge. So you'll have the judge judging. And you'll find throughout the whole of these blessings of Genesis 49, there is this little byplay going on with the names all the way through. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that. So there is a future role for, in the prophetic picture for the last days, for Dan as a judge. And if you tie that in with the New Testament, that the saints will be judges of the kingdom of God, there is a direct linkage there, which I'll go back to in a few seconds. Watch the time. Genesis 49, verse 17. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that bites the horse's heels so the rider shall fall backwards. Now, I'm not going to go into all the ramifications of that, but let me use an example of one of the great personages of the tribe of Dan. This is one that most children remember. One of the great personages of the tribe of Dan was Samson. And when you look at the characteristics of Samson, he embodies the very characteristics that were described in Genesis 49. He was, could I say, unsteady, unscrupulous. I'd even include that he had a black sense of humor. And if you read the story of Samson, you would agree with that. He had a violent aspect to him. And he was almost like a stealth, undermining sort of aspect, which again fulfilled the characteristic that was described here in Genesis 49, a serpent in the way, an adder in the path. And then you go back, in the Bible, to another man who's on his deathbed. This time the man on his deathbed is another famous person in the Bible called Moses. And Moses, on his deathbed, also makes some prognostications about the house and the tribes of Israel. And in Daniel 33, verse 22, Moses says about Daniel, he just makes this simple statement, he's a lion's whelp that leaps forth from Bashan. Now, Bashan was very known for the strong, powerful beasts of cows or bulls. So here you have a description of a powerful characteristic of Dan like a lion coming from Bashan. So there is a connection here that he's swift, and even said in Genesis 49, swift and strong in striking. Now, I won't say a lot at this point, and again, I'm only focusing in on one tribe of part of Dan, because I do understand there is another aspect of Dan more towards Denmark and so forth. But I'm looking at the Irish side because that's where I was first in my ministry. And I'll leave it for you to think about the description of Samson. I'll leave it to you to think about the description of Genesis 49 and apply that to the modern day tribe of Dan and some of the descriptions I gave. And so you can think about whether they fit in with the characteristic of the people today. And then verse 18 in Genesis 49, he says, I have waited for the salvation of the Lord. Now this is a very interesting one. You can be what you see and say, well, there you are, a people waiting for the salvation of God. There is another aspect to this that can be understood. I won't turn to it, but you rush forward in the Bible, right to the very end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation. There is a non-reference to Dan, I should put that more correctly. When it refers to a group of people called 144,000, I'm not going to explain all that here, I haven't got the time. But in that description, you'll find that Dan is not mentioned. But also, if you study the genealogies, which none of us like to do too much, I certainly don't, in 1 Chronicles 1 to 12, chapters 1 to 12, you find a very detailed genealogy of all the tribes of Israel, except for Dan. which is similar to the exclusion of Dan you find in Revelation. Now, why is that so? Why is that the case? Dan was the first of the organized idolatry of ancient Israel and had the longest history of idolatry in the duration. And it even mentions in part of the Bible that this duration was from until the day of the captivity in the land. So a period of over 500 years of idolatry. Dan had a history of all the tribes of Israel of thoroughly rejecting God's true religion for thousands of years and substituting a tradition of idolatry. You know, even the old Talmud or Talmudic tradition says that Dan was the first tribe to follow Jeroboam into idolatry. And in Talmudic writings, you'll find that Dan is used as a word portraying literally idolatry. Instead of using the word idolatry in the Talmud, they often refer to Dan. So if you're referring to idolatry, you're referring to Dan. So there is sometimes, a lot of scholars will feel there is a connection between that type of behavior and the reason for their exclusion from the genealogies of Chronicles and the final 144,000 mentioned in Revelation. Now, how does that fit in with "I have waited for the salvation of O Lord"? This could be an explanation that the tribe of Dan, in a general sense, will not have many people at the beginning stages of the plan of God, and that they will have to wait till the sealing of this 144,000 before they can be a part of the future. But it is interesting for all us of Dan to recognize that the Apostle Paul did say, though, that all of Israel shall be saved. That gives my tribe hope. All Israel, including Dan. The tribe of Dan must wait until the kingdom of God, to what many of us in this room believe the millennial period, is established before the majority will be saved. They have to wait for the salvation. The Bible mentions Dan, interestingly enough, when it talks about the apportionment of the land during the period of the millennium. It refers to Dan first in the apportionment. So there is a reverse that begins to take place. From the exclusion in the genealogies of Chronicles, the exclusion from this number of the 144,000, there is this millennial context of the first one to be mentioned for the apportionment in the land. Dan, like all the tribes of Israel, will have a future, a established future in the kingdom of God. Now, before I conclude, I would like to say to any of the guests here and the people from all over the area, the United Church of God presently is producing a book on the US and BC that Rick Sherrod has been one of the major contributors to. I think the last I heard that it will be out in November. Is that correct? Hopefully. Hopefully. Now, if you would like to order that, there are some forms at the back, is that correct, Craig, somewhere, that you can put your name and address on that, and we will and make sure that when the book is produced that it will be sent out to you if you wish. I will ensure that there will be no other follow-up literature or contact made with you because you left your name there. We're not going to use that as an opportunity to get your name on a file or anything. We just want to have that opportunity because we haven't got that quite produced yet. It will be produced, as I said, hopefully the end of the year. Then once we get a stock of these over here in Australia, we'll keep a list of those of your names, and we'll send you the booklet as soon as we get it. And we'll just keep favour for that. So thank you very much for your time, and I'll turn it back to Doug Gray.
Thank you very much, Bruce, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Gray, and hello to everybody. Looks like we've got a few that came along for the afternoon who weren't here this morning. and it's nice to have all of you out here. Mr. White, again, I'll give thanks to him for all the organization that he has put into this. Craig has done a great deal to make this activity come together. As we were discussing just before I came up here a few minutes ago, he told me to tell you that tomorrow is going to really be interesting. And I guess by that, today is not going to be that interesting. I'm not sure what he meant by that. But if we strike a chord today with some of the things that we raise and discuss, and you have an interest in this subject, we will be going again tomorrow at 10:30. Is that when the morning? 10 o'clock? 11. At 11 o'clock, we will have a second of these presentations, and then again we'll have one in the afternoon. We started just a little bit late here this afternoon, so I will try to wrap up whatever comments I have by 4:18. I think we started it, and I got it right on my watch at 2:18, and we'll tie things together. As one of my old colleagues in the ministry used to say, we're going to quit whether we're finished or not. We're going to be done whether we're finished or not. So we'll have tomorrow the couple of presentations tomorrow to pick up any slack that we might not be able to wrap things up today. Depending on how fastly we progress through this material, we may need to make a tray change and adjustment, which will take about 2 minutes as we get toward the end of the day, but we'll deal with that. We may not get that far, and if we don't, then we won't have to worry about that. But if we do, we'll have a brief intermission for about 2 minutes, and then we'll get going again. One other aside, the projector cord runs through here, and once we get done this afternoon, any of those of you who are using this as a pathway, you might want to be careful lest you get tangled up in that cord. Would hate for you to hurt yourself, and then also the possibility of damaging the projection equipment, which would mean the presentations will end today. The Commonwealth of Nations as predicted in the Bible, that's a large subject. It's a huge piece. It's a long and a rich story, and there are many diverse strands. There are many contributors who have added their voices to a chorus who contribute to the debate, the discussion, and so on this. What I will do today primarily, and I mentioned this for those of you who were here this morning when we had our earlier meeting, what I will try to do is focus a bit on some of prophecy that has been fulfilled in retrospect, looking back across the historical record. We'll spend really the next day and a half of these presentations exploring various aspects of how the people of the British Commonwealth and also how the Americans have evolved and risen to greatness, really unlike anything that we see in the recorded historical record. What I want you to do in these presentations that I've made, primarily in North America, but to some degree in Britain and also the Middle East and a few other places, Canada, I'd like for you to keep three or four main concepts in the back of your mind. Now, what is prophecy for? I guess we could put all these under the umbrella of that question or issue. The first concept is that our actions have long-term consequences. What you and I do today is going to affect what our lives are like tomorrow. It may affect our lives for good. It may affect our lives for ill. A scripture that you might want just to note in connection with it would be Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. It speaks specifically relevant, I think, to the second commandment about not worshiping idols. But in principle, it applies pretty much across the board in whatever we do. It says, I am the Lord your God, a jealous God. I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. If we make mistakes, if we make, as sometimes we put it today, poor choices, those consequences will come back upon our heads. Now, there's a flip side to that coin, and the material that we'll explore today and tomorrow, I think, is a grand testimony. It's the story of Joseph, of Ephraim, of Manasseh, and also of Reuben, writ large in the history of their descendants. And we'll see, on the one hand, the long-term consequences of those who have chosen poorly, but we'll also see the long-term consequences of those who fulfill what it says, continuing on in verse 6 of Exodus chapter 20, that God shows mercy unto thousands of those who love him and keep his commandments. Now, a second concept to me which has been helpful, and you'll see this as a theme which will emerge and reemerge throughout the discourse today and tomorrow. And that, I call it, for lack of a better description, the Holy Day Connection. As I gaze out on the audience, I notice some of you are here that were not here for this morning's presentations. Let me talk just for a moment about the tradition within the Church of God. We in the Church of God, regardless of whether it's United, Global, International, or the various other branches, I guess you could say, of the Church of God, we take seriously the holy days and the direction that God gives to observe those holy days as described in Leviticus 23. It is a matter of fact in terms of both biblical record and also Hebrew tradition that in the history or the unfolding of the history of the Israelitish people, God has chosen to act sometimes very dramatically, sometimes flamboyantly, in interesting ways on the holy days in advancing the history, the fortunes, if you will, of the Israelitish people. Let me give you a few examples as points of reference. The first is traditional within the Hebrew community, that being that Adam, the first human being, was created on the sixth day of the week as it began to draw to closure. And as the sun set on that particular Friday afternoon, you passed into what was a double Sabbath, the seventh day Sabbath. But it happened to fall in the fall season of the year, and it was on the first day of the seventh month, which we in the Church of God understand and recognize to be the Feast of Trumpets, one of the great celebrations, the great holy days within the Hebrew community and also within our own Church of God community. You move forward a little bit further, and as I mentioned in the sermon I gave this morning, Genesis 17, the tradition there is that the reconfirmation of the covenant to Abraham, on whom all these blessings were conferred, and the blessings, of course, were passed on to the what I would term the Anglo-American descendants of Joseph. That reconfirmation of the covenant described in Genesis 17 fell on the first day of unleavened bread. You move forward another 430 years, and you come to the point where the Old Testament Israelites made their exodus in connection with Passover and the days of unleavened bread. They left Egypt, departing on the first day of unleavened bread, and by tradition, and also deducing from what the Scripture says itself, on the last day of unleavened bread, a day which, in a sense, represents to spiritual Israelites today, Christians, regardless of our ethnic background or makeup, that last day represents the final overcoming of Egypt, which is to say, in a spiritual sense, sin in our lives. And according to the tradition, it was on that last or seventh day of unleavened bread that the Egyptians pursued the Israelites into the sea. And if you have it like I do in your mind's eye, the Cecil B. DeMille imagery of the Ten Commandments, the slapping together of those walls of water and the destruction of Pharaoh's hosts. Pentecost is a day on which the law supposedly was given. That's a tradition among the Hebrew community. And then on we could go talking about various activities in connection with fall or spring festivals. One which perhaps is lesser well known, if you can recall the days of the Assyrian invasion of the kingdom of Judah. Around 701 B.C. or thereabouts, in 2 Kings 19, 2 Chronicles 32, Isaiah 37. You have this dramatic account of how Isaiah and the children of Judah appealed to God to rescue them out of their time of trouble when the Assyrians besieged them. They looked out across the horizon when they woke up, I believe it was the next morning, but the Hebrew tradition there is that developed in connection or on the Jewish Passover, the day of Passover itself. It is not surprising then, as we'll take a look in the remaining time today and then tomorrow in the two presentations, that you find, interestingly, that same kind of pattern woven in to the history of the more recent Anglo-American peoples. Major key watershed events corresponding to key holy day dates. I'll leave it at that, but you'll see that theme reemerge. A third concept is that God is alive and well, and that God is involved in what happens in human history. He intervenes. A number of years ago, I once heard a man make a presentation talking about Satan's fingerprints being all over human history. And I think that's a right judgment. You pick up a copy, let's say, of the Sydney Morning Herald or the Daily Telegraph, and most of the time what you're going to read as headlines are going to be things that are bad news. tragedies, murders, various other things that are certainly outside the law of God. If Satan's fingerprints are all over this world society, there's a flip side to that proposition as well. So, for those whose eyes are illuminated by God's Spirit to see it, so is the handprint of God. Now, we can't necessarily put that in a test tube and scientifically prove it, but like Winston Churchill once said, there are times, and I believe he said this in the context of the Second World War, there are times when I sense that something has moved. He implied some providential turn of events which made a difference in the long-term outcome of world affairs and world politics. If God was that way in the past, which certainly, if we believe the Bible, He was, God is the same today, yesterday, and will be forever. And I submit that we're dealing with the same being, the same individual, as we live our lives today and examine the history of our Anglo-American peoples. A fourth concept that might be helpful, dealing with prophecy, is that there are certain patterns. In our tradition, we oftentimes refer to it as duality. There will be events that are, if you want to call them this, forerunners of what will take place yet again in the future. And in this presentation and the two which follow, we'll come back to those concepts from time to time and look at things that have occurred in the past, look at certain elements of prophecy, and what becomes readily apparent is that these are very likely forerunners of things to come that lay on the horizon that we maybe perhaps even in our own lifetimes will see fulfilled. Then finally, the matrix of ideas that I want to present while I'm here in Sydney really ties to three major prophecies relevant to the children of Israel. I talked a little bit about each of these this morning. Let me go back to them once again. Especially within the period of the turn of the 19th century, we see the fulfillment and the unfolding, the coming together, the parallel fulfillment, I guess would be the best way to describe it, of prophecies in Genesis 48, Genesis 49, which Mr. Dean made reference to, and then again, 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 2. Let me go back and summarize the essence of what I want to coax from each of those passages. Genesis 48 speaks of the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh by the patriarch Jacob. He conferred a blessing upon the heads of the two sons of Joseph, in essence saying they would grow together to become a large people in number. There would come a point in time when they would separate and go their own different respective directions. We're going to look at some aspects of that today. It was a troubled time in the story of the British Commonwealth or the British Empire. Genesis 49, Mr. Dean referred to verse 1, which makes specific reference to the last days. And in Genesis 49, verses 22 through 26, there is a rich, beautiful, detailed prophecy of blessings that are destined and have indeed overtaken the descendants of Joseph to boost them, to elevate them to a station in world history that really I don't think any other people have ever been able to enjoy. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 2, and perhaps this is somewhat unique. We heard a moment or two ago about the tribe of Dan. Well, each vignette that you find in Genesis 49 speaks to the future in the last days of the 12 sons of the patriarch Jacob. Reuben was the firstborn son from the union between Jacob and Leah. What we find in 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 2 is a prophecy, a prediction that Reuben, because of a personal indiscretion, he slept with one of his father's wives. He forfeited the right of primogeniture, which would have given him the privilege of having the double portion of the birthright blessing. Verses 1 and 2 of 1 Chronicles 5 talk at length about that. And as we explore the history of Joseph, of Ephraim, of Manasseh, there will be significant vignettes, cameo appearances, that Reuben and his descendants, and I would identify Reuben today as many of those who are British Israelite persuasion, I would locate those peoples as being principally settled in the region of the nation-state today that we would call the nation of France. Okay, now, if we can come up with the first slide. Let's go ahead and go with that. I concluded what I spoke on earlier today with Genesis 45 and verse 3. And here you see, I believe it's an 18th century rendition of Joseph revealing himself to his brethren. Interesting piece of artwork. It holds, in one sense, the dramatic impact, I guess you could say, of Da Vinci's Last Supper, the revelation that one of you shall betray me, although that was certainly a more important spiritual aspect to the story. In this instance, and I concluded today with this question, are we looking at something that is prophetic, as are many aspects and elements of the life of the patriarch Joseph? Is there coming a time when Joseph's identity is going to be revealed? And I think undoubtedly that is the case. As we draw closer to the end of this age, I think the voice which makes that proclamation will become increasingly loud. Let's go to the next illustration then. For those of you who come out of my own tradition, which is Church of God, you may remember Basil Wolverton. Okay? Artwork, some chuckles through the audience. Mr. Wolverton did a lot of artwork for many of the publications that the Worldwide Church of God did many, many years ago. And here you see his rendition of Potiphar's wife attempting to seduce Joseph. I put it here simply to make the point, or make the emphasis, that you have a young man, 17, 18, 19 perhaps years of age, who resisted the pull. In this case, it was a sin of sexual nature. But he stood fast, stood his ground. The payoff was not immediate. But isn't it interesting that both Joseph and Reuben, as I characterized it earlier today, the two firstborn offspring of the patriarch Jacob, Reuben from the union that Jacob had with Leah, Joseph from the union that Jacob had with Rachel, the mother of Joseph, both experienced the same kind of challenge and test. One failed, the other did not. And although it took a while for blessings to begin to overtake Joseph personally, and I would interject here, for the blessings promised in the Bible to overtake Joseph's descendants nationally, it really did not begin to unfold in a concerted way until around the mid to late 18th century, and then especially gain momentum as we move into the 19th century. You can think back to this, and it sends a message, I think, to us today about the need to live our lives within the confines of God's principles, laws, judgments, statutes, and so on. The next illustration, we'll take a look at the man that I spoke for a while about this morning, the patriarch Abraham. The blessings went to him. They fell upon his head. He passed the series of tests through which God put him. And in the long run, the blessings came upon his head. Now, in the next illustration, you'll see, and there will be some familiar heraldic imagery here probably, in this part of the world at least. When I present this material to American audiences, they're not quite as well acquainted with some of the various signs and symbols of British and Commonwealth heraldry. I find this to be a helpful way to get to what to me is an important and also an interesting point. This is the British Royal Arms. It happens to be the one of Henry VI. He was a king of England from 1399. To 1413. But what's wrong with this picture? If you just look at it in a certain respect of looking at it as representative of the British royal household. If you look at the shield in the center, you have in the lower left and upper right the expected heraldic symbols of the lion. And that dates back. There's a delightful little book which many of you may know of and probably some of you own by a fellow named Bennett, called Symbols of Our Celto-Saxon Heritage, I believe is the title. But he gives one of the best explanations to some of these heraldic type things. The lion from around the time of Richard the Lionheart came to be associated with the royal house in England. But in the opposing quarters, what's that all about? What is that? That, of course, is not a British symbol, is it? Now, it's called the fleur-de-lis, or maybe loosely translated into the English, the royal lily, and it's a French symbol. This remained a part of royal British heraldry, or English and then British heraldry, right up until I believe around the time of Queen Victoria. I forget exactly when the transition was made, and it was finally removed from the British royal arms. But my point in this is a simple one, in that you have, even in the heraldic symbols, an interesting expression of a very important competition that would develop and that would evolve as you get to more recent, more modern day history of the Anglo-American peoples. If you happen to have a King James Version of the Bible, we can illustrate it this way. The lights are down and you may not be able to see it. But when I used to teach at Ambassador College, I taught a course called Ancient Israel, and sometimes I would have a little fun with my students, and I would ask them, who's the first king named in the Bible? And hands would go up, and some would say, well, that would be David. No, that's not right. Well, that would be Saul. No, that's not right. Well, how about Abimelech in the book? No, that's not right either. And I would tell them, the first king named in the Bible is King James. If you look at the dedicatory statement, a page or two in, now this is only if you have the authorized version. If you have some of the newer versions, that won't be true. But you don't get more than a line or two before you read, and of course James the First of England became, James the Sixth of Scotland became James the First, King of England in 1603 with the passing of Queen Elizabeth, the one earlier than the lady whose portrait is hung here in this hall. And James claimed title to the throne in France, as well as his many other titles over territory in Europe. Now, in the next illustration, what you'll see is an artist's rendition of, I suppose, any penetration into history is somewhat arbitrary in terms of where you start and where you end. But the gentleman that you see here is one artist's reproduction of what he believed a fellow named William the Conqueror might have looked like. William went by other names, William of Hastings, and then some other names that we don't speak publicly about on, in polite society. But he was a remarkable figure. And I suppose you can, in one way, date the intensification, perhaps even the beginnings, of the Anglo-French conflict in Europe with an important transition that evolved in the year 1066, interestingly enough, in the fall of that year in October. And the next illustration will show you, this is part of the very famous Biotapestry. If memory serves me correctly, I think there were a group of nuns that memorialized this, the invasion of William. William crossed the English Channel and lodged his claim for the English throne. That in itself is a fairly fascinating story. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going to go into battle, I think I could follow someone named Richard Lionheart. And that's my kind of guy. If we're going to be unsheathing swords and going out to lop off heads and challenge claims for territory and the like. In 1066, there was a king in England who didn't inspire quite so much confidence. He was known as Edward the Confessor. Okay? He was a very pious man. In fact, many of his interests seemed to be more oriented toward religion, hence the name, the descriptor, Confessor. Edward is an interesting study in many respects, not the least of which is he is the only person I have ever heard of who, on the day after his wedding, took a vow of perpetual chastity. I suppose that's a subject all in itself, and we will not explore that. Inasmuch as it affected British history, it created an immediate difficulty or problem. When you don't consummate a relationship in marriage, you don't produce offspring. And when you happen to be a king, you create a vacuum of power. Into this vacuum rushed numerous figures. Harold Godwinson happened to be first on the scene with the most, at least initially. Godwinson, in a somewhat small gathering of what was a primitive version of what we would call today the Parliament, received authentication. He was given the crown. But William, who was an illegitimate successor to the throne through things that had happened prior to Edward the Confessor, William believed that he had a better claim, and with the imprimatur or the authority of the Pope, he launched an invasion. And if we can go to the next illustration, you'll see here a part, that segment, a part of the Biotapestry of William engaging in battle the troops of Harold. This took place, interestingly enough, on October the 14th in the year 1066, which in the Hebrew calendar, on the Hebrew calendar, falls on the last great day. It was a major transition, a significant turning point. From that point forward, William and his Anglo-Norman ruling class really reshaped the direction of English history. It, by the way, as probably most of you know, was the last successful major invasion of the British Isles. Now, in the next illustration, if we can go forward one, The thing that makes this significant in our study, and I'm trying to take a somewhat long view of British and imperial history, is that William brought with him the claim to vast tracts of territory in France. Even his name, we can, let's see, there we go, there's the laser. If you can see where the light is on this map, William, of course, came from this region of Normandy, same site on June 6, 1944, that the Allied troops invaded and eventually drove back Adolf Hitler's troops. From 1066 until you get all the way down to the mid-1550s here, and the historical progression would go like this. You can see those darkly shaded areas are territories that England latched onto, firmly held, tried to retain, and really from that point forward, you have an antipathy between the French and the English people that runs, well, depending on how you measure it, it really extends right on up until the early part of the 20th century. It began to abate in a significant way when Napoleon Bonaparte, a French, well, he wasn't a Frenchman, he was a general in charge of France and the better part of Europe, on June 18th, 1815, met his defeat at a place called Waterloo on the day of Pentecost. Now, in looking at these maps, you can see that by the mid-16th century, England's territorial holdings had diminished down to a little bitty region just across from England, English Channel separating the two territories. The region in France was called Calais. This was a period of protracted warfare. Now, in the next illustration, you'll see one sample of that. This is a classic textbook-type photo that you might remember from your days in school. One of the main episodes of this conflict was oftentimes known, or historians have called it today, the First 100 Years' War. From 1388 to 1453, England and France were on again, off again, at war with one another, pretty much through the better part, actually beyond 100 years, more than a century. In the long run, the French seemed to always win out. Many of the great battles, like the one represented here, you see the English decisively winning, but sooner or later, the nod always went to France. And eventually, England found herself pushed entirely off the continent. Now let's go to the next illustration, or the next visual. Now, at the time, and let me, I'm, as Mr. Dean said, we're both ministers, so I'm going to preach at you for just a moment, okay? I want to deduce certain lessons of life from some of the things that I'll present to you here today that might go a little bit beyond the immediate interest that we have in this in terms of where are the Israelites today and their Anglo-American connection. In the 1550s, when Mary the First lost that last English holding on the continent of Europe, most people in England looked at that as a major foreign policy defeat. And that's nationally, but it's a principle that drives you and me individually. In our own lives, when we suffer defeat, for instance, if you were to go to work on Monday and you went in and your boss came in and said, thank you very much for your fine service, but we no longer need you here. Most of us would not look at that as a positive, favorable development. Moreover, we tend to try to recoup our losses. We tend to try to recover our losses. In some respects, the English would spend some little time trying to do that, looking at the French as the vehicle of their misfortune. Certainly they would. But in point of fact, the loss of England's last continental territory in the mid-16th century, what shall we call it? A setting of the stage? It was positioning the English people to launch into what would eventually be the inheritance of what would constitute about 25%, I believe, or 20% of the Earth's landmass, the construction of the British Empire. Now, the person whose image is now on screen, you may or may not recognize as someone who originated out of Genoa, Italy, although that probably was not his ethnic background. His name was Cristobal Colon. We know him better in the English world as Christopher Columbus. The whole story of Columbus is a fascinating one in regard to the unfolding over the long stretch of Anglo-American history. In 1492, Christopher Columbus set sail, let's go to the next illustration, in the service of the Spanish king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella. Now, this, some of you chuckle. Yeah, this is from an old Wall Street Journal advertisement that I picked up years ago. It takes money to do things, doesn't it? Christopher Columbus didn't have that money, or at least he didn't have the kind of financing to test his thesis or his ideas. Ironically, Henry VII, the King of England, was on the verge of bankrolling this expedition, but it wasn't, frankly, brethren, quite time for the English to make their entry onto center stage in world history. It was the day for Spain to advance to what we might call their heyday. Ferdinand and Isabella had only recently united their kingdom in 1492. Having done that, Isabella in particular was somewhat willing to invest in ventures that might produce profit. And although the Columbus voyage seemed like something of a long shot, on April 17th in 1492, which was the sixth day of unleavened bread, Columbus received official approval to make his voyage. Now, in the next illustration, another part of the backdrop that you see here, once again, a fascinating part of the story. This is prior to Martin Luther. Martin Luther began doing what he did in the early 16th century. Roman Catholicism dominated at that time in terms of European religion, that version of Christianity. And Isabella, who was very much influenced by the various confessors and major religious figures in Spain, was persuaded by folks like the man you see holding the cross aloft, a man named Thomas de Torquemada. De Torquemada prompted the Spanish monarchy to issue an edict of expulsion, driving all of the religious minorities out of the newly formed kingdom. Now, in 1492, that comprised only two groups. We're not dealing with Protestant versus Catholic just yet. What we're looking at would be the Muslim minority, the Moors as they were called, and the group that you see kneeling before the Spanish monarchs, beseeching mercy, which in fact never came, the Jewish community within the confines of what was now the Kingdom of Spain. The interesting sideline, and let's go now to the next illustration. This is a little book, and if the name rings a bell, you may have heard of the author, Simon Wiesenthal, in connection with tracking down Nazi war criminals. If I remember correctly, I believe Wiesenthal was the man who probably captured Adolf Eichmann and then a number of lesser people in the hierarchy of the Nazi war criminal group. Wiesenthal put together a fascinating book. If you are able to come up with it, if you have it in the local library, which, by the way, I had the opportunity to drop by the New South Wales Library, which is a fascinating facility. It may be there. If it's not, perhaps you can get it through interlibrary loan facilities. But this, the story that Wiesenthal sketches is truly a remarkable one. Now, Columbus, make no mistake, Christopher Columbus was in this, like most of us are in most things in life for, to make money. He had hoped to sail to the east, undercut the overland trade routes, and buy directly from those in the far east. If he had done that, he would have become a quite wealthy man. Wiesenthal also suggests a rather startling notion, and that is, as implied in the title, that Columbus's agenda was more diverse, that Columbus had great sympathies for the Jewish community within Spain and Europe. And that especially as the Jews came under intense pressure as we move into the early 1490s, he hoped to be able to connect them with a group of individuals, the Lost Ten Tribes possibly, who may have immigrated at some distant time in the past and could be found by these voyages. Now again, it's circumstantial. Most things in life, I suppose, proof for them are circumstantial. But the notion was, and indeed, I think it was around 10% of his crew members were made up of people that were ethnically Jewish. It is not a coincidence that the timing of Columbus's voyage fell on August the 2nd, 1492. Two aspects of that, to me, are compelling. Number one, that is the date that Isabella made effective the Edict of Expulsion, driving the Jews out of Spain. Now, August the 2nd is not a holy day date, but if you're familiar with Hebrew tradition, you may be well aware that 50 days prior to the Feast of Trumpets, the Jewish community, the conservative Jewish community, typically observes a fast day. It's the ninth day of Ab, or the fifth month on the Hebrew calendar. It's a day which commemorates the destruction first of Solomon's temple and then later the Herodian temple. And it's a day which has a connotation of heaviness, of trouble for the people who are Jews around the world. In this instance, it was that day, August 2nd, that Columbus set sail with a significant percentage of Jewish crew members, including, I believe, his own physician aboard that ship. Now, let's carry it to the next slide and a step further in terms of the unfolding of this story. You probably don't have Columbus Day on your pocket calendars here in the Southern Hemisphere in Australia. In North America, typically October 12th is designated as a holiday. It's called Columbus Day. And in 1492, Christopher Columbus, as this early American currency note shows us, set foot for the first time in terms of, well, at least in recent history, a European set foot on, well, at least Caribbean, if not North American soil. That was October the 12th, the seventh day that year of the Feast of Tabernacles. Columbus truly opened up the flood of exploration and ultimately colonization and settlement, which founded, as they called it in those days, Mundus Novus, or the New World. Now, if we can go on to the next illustration. In North America, this took on an interesting turn in terms of exploration and settlement. Ironically, the story of North America is organically and intimately connected to the story of settlement in Australia, and I'll come to that momentarily. This region that you see in North America is the St. Lawrence River Valley, and it was one of the first areas to really be opened up and explored, not by those who were the first and most successful in the age of discovery or the age of exploration. The Portuguese and the Spanish, who today we don't think of as being impressive, overwhelming colonial powers, in the 15th century and on into the 16th and to some degree even on into the 17th, those were the most powerful nations in the world. The Spanish and the Portuguese opened up the new regions, which eventually broadcast settlement of European peoples literally around the world. When it came time that England and France and Holland, for that matter, became interested in joining in the competition, those territories that were available were in those days considered the wilderness territories, the leftovers, perhaps refuse is too strong a statement. But what now today, at least in North America and in Canada and the United States, would be prime value real estate, this wasn't considered all that valuable way back when. It reminds me of a scripture that you find, I believe it's in Jeremiah chapter 30, which says, Israel shall find grace in the wilderness. Once again, Australia was a largely unsettled territory whenever in the 1780s, Cook and then Philip and then others came into this region and began to plant British flags and the like. Now, I want to talk for a moment or two about North America because of the nature of the competition that developed. You had some Dutch settlement, even as you had down in this, or some exploration, I should say, down in this area of the world. But the two main competitors were the French and the English. Now, isn't that a curious historical fact? You have, in essence, the two firstborns or their descendants lining up in competition for one another for, in essence, the same territory. Latecomers to the game of colonial rivalry, but nonetheless locked in what will be an increasingly intense struggle with one another for overseas territory, for markets, and for regions to control and to market their various products. Now let's go to the next illustration. The French, as a rule, oftentimes arrived in advance. This is part of a general pattern. If you look at colonial history, and we're putting the focus at the moment on North America, they came, once again, for motives that drive most of us. That is, we have to make a living, we have to make ends meet, and they came to make money. Those who did this primarily were interested in the fishing industry off the Newfoundland coast and elsewhere, and the fur trading industry, as represented by this period print. Now, the next slide will show the other main reason. If we can go ahead and go to the next. There was also a perhaps more noble motivation on the part of some who came with the idea of bringing Christianity to the native peoples. This happens to be an illustration of Jacques Cartier's first voyage in the 1530s. So the French were, well, this would be well in advance of the first English settlement in the early 1600s along the eastern seaboard of North America. But the French came and many were intent on spreading the religion of Christianity. Examples of those who led the way. The next illustration is a close-up, again, of a man named Jacques Cartier. Among other things, Cartier opened up the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, or well, it was already open, I suppose. He discovered where it was in 1534. The next illustration will go to a prime French mover, this man named Champlain, the man who founded the city of Quebec. And we'll come back and talk about Quebec here in a moment or two and the unfolding of the story that we're looking at of the rivalry between English colonial expansion and French colonial expansion in competition with each other. The next illustration that we'll go to would be another individual named Robert LaSalle. Now, yesterday, Mr. Shaw, Mr. Allett, took us up into the Blue Mountains, and we had a chance to look down into the valley and see the rivers and the regions of settlement and so forth. This particular individual, LaSalle, was the man who opened up what many considered the heartland. He didn't open it up. He explored the heartland of North America. Now, let's go to the next illustration. When I saw this, I thought it's a really good way to illustrate what was happening between England and France at this stage of opening up colonial imperial empires. LaSalle, the Frenchman, is pushed to the background. In the foreground, you have a famous American settler and explorer. Yesterday, once again, going up to the Blue Mountains, Mr. Allett told me a lot about how the Australian colonist pushed over the Blue Mountains to see what was on the other side. Well, in North America, the dynamic was driven by people much like Daniel Boone, the man you see in the foreground. The illustration is interesting to me for several reasons, but the one I want to point out here, are we looking at brothers, or descendants, perhaps I should say, of brothers, locked in a grand fraternal struggle, a colonial rivalry for overseas territory, colonial markets, and various resources? The pattern is compelling, because typically the French arrived there first, but the English arrived there to stay. Now, when Vivian Ellis took me the first day my daughters and I were here, we went out into the area of Botany Bay. And I had read this, I think, in Robert Hughes's book, Fatal Shore, some years ago, but I had forgotten it. It is interesting that the French, if they had arrived just a little bit earlier in the area of Botany Bay, would have been able to plant the fleur-de-lis, or the French flag, in this area of the world. And the story could have evolved in a quite different way than it did. Reuben and Joseph, for me, I think that's a very compelling explanation. Now, let's move to the next illustration, which will show a map of the relative amount of real estate that the main colonial powers had as you really begin to move into this age of exploration, ultimately settlement, and then in the long run, the founding of one of the grandest, well, the largest anyway, empire. I guess maybe the Soviet Union had a bit larger amount of territory. But the British Empire, which was a non-contiguous empire with territories encircling the globe. In North America, The orange-shaded regions represent those territories that were held by Spain. Spain, by the time we get to this element of the story, 1700, this would be the year of these boundaries. By 1700, Spain was pretty much a power past its heyday. It was decrepit. It had spent its best energies and would continually forfeit increasing blocks of territory as the next 200 years wore on. In the heartland of North America, you see the blue shaded territory. 1700, most of that belonged to Brother Reuben, at least by right of claim. The Mississippi River Valley, vast tracts of territory extending all the way up through the Canadian Shield region and on. The more maroon, pinkish shaded area would be territory claimed by the English, and then that is hashed are hash shaded would be territory disputed by the French and the English. Now, next illustration will form a bridge. In 1689, a very critical transition took place in English history. If you were there at the time, perhaps it didn't seem quite as important, I think, as ultimately in retrospect it became. And particularly, viewing it through the lens of the prism that we who understand the origins of the Anglo-American people, it takes on a remarkable significance. The man on the left is William of Orange. He was the chief political figure, the Dutch stadtholder, prime minister by description of office, over the Dutch Republic. Now, in England, because of certain things that had happened, particularly in politics, to run the risk of trying to retain the throne, and William and his wife, Mary, who was tied to the royal Stuart line in England, were invited to cross the English Channel to come over from Holland and to serve as the King and Queen of England. Now, let's advance to the next slide. This is a late 17th century piece of artwork commemorating the enthronement of William and Mary. And I like it because it helps to illustrate a point that I want to get at here. William really, in many respects, didn't all that much care to be King of England one way or the other, except for the fact that it gave him access to one of the richest treasure troves of resources in all of Europe. William had spent pretty much a lifetime embattled by the enemy on his southwestern border, the Kingdom of France. And when William had the opportunity to add to his titles and also his resources for making war, the king, or the crown, I should say, of England, he was very quick to take advantage of it. In that context and setting begins what historians sometimes call the Second 100 Years' War. And from 1689 to 1815, France and England are continually, well, not continually, but on again, off again, at war against one another. There are seven respective conflicts that can be identified in the history books within that general time frame of a little bit more, actually, than 100 years. Now, I like this illustration in part, and I'll go back to the title of this presentation, The Commonwealth of Nations Predicted in the Bible. No, you can't prove a lot of the things that we'll look at here this afternoon in a scientific test tube. But on the other hand, we can look at the Bible, and it does say in places like Daniel chapter 4 and places in the Psalms, and by implication elsewhere in many places, that God is concerned with who is in position of authority at various points along the historical timeline. That he, in some cases, is intensely concerned. In fact, so much so that rather than just allow, he actually selects and places people to accomplish his respective ends. Book of Exodus would be a case in point. The Pharaoh, in the time of Moses and the Israelites, was a man whom God apparently had maybe even groomed to some degree for the job to accomplish his ends, to do the things that took place during the period of the Israelite exodus out of Egypt. In this illustration, which was very characteristic of that day in the late 1600s, you see various angelic beings, and I ask myself, you know, is the artist hitting on something there more than perhaps he himself even realized? I think that the answer undoubtedly is yes. I think that this opens an era of Anglo-French conflict, which is a working out as we progress rapidly toward the releasing of an unconditional birthright that had been promised to Abraham, passed on to Isaac, given to Jacob, then passed on to Joseph, and ultimately to Ephraim and Manasseh and the host of their descendants, which ultimately would populate what we know today as the Anglo-American world. Next illustration we'll go to. I use this to move forward somewhat. There were many conflicts in the working out of this empire building, the antagonism between France and England. But one that sets the stage for a fulfillment of prophecy, namely Genesis 48, is what was known, at least in North America, as the French and Indian War. In Europe, where that same war was going on in a different theater. It was called the 7 Years' War. There was also, more close to here where we are in Australia, in India, there was intense fighting between the French and the English there as well. I view it from a biblical perspective, I would argue, as this Reubenite-Josephite controversy. As we move toward the turn of the 19th century, I wonder if we take the prophecies, and I won't get into too much detail here. I'll be happy to discuss some of these aspects with any of you who would like to talk afterwards over coffee and tea. But Leviticus 26 implies that there will be a withholding of that birthright for 2,520 years from the time that Israel, the northern kingdom, is cast away into captivity. And that brings us out into the late 18th and early 20th centuries. That, in essence, is about where we are. We're a little bit, I guess, in advance of that. But what we find in the French and Indian War is, again, a remarkable part of this story. Now, let's take it a step further. Go to the next slide. The war did not go well. George III, and I was a couple of you, and I have had interesting discussions about good old George III. In Australia, he probably is looked at as a somewhat admired British monarch. In America, remember, this is the fellow. Well, in the hierarchy of beings, this is the way they teach this stuff in American schools. There is Satan the devil, his demons, and not that far underneath that those two groups would be George III. Okay? Now, my history I learned from a British perspective. My doctoral degree is in history of the British Empire, or British Imperial Studies by another name. George really wasn't all that bad a guy. What we find here is that, let's go back, Laura, if we can, one, see if it will reverse. Yeah, let's go back to this. Let me talk for just a moment before we go to that next slide. I should develop it. Here's George, and we'll come back to George here in a few minutes and talk a bit more about him. The prime minister of that day, at least as the war began to, as it began to evolve, was a man named William Pitt. You have a street in downtown Sydney, which I went by, which is probably named for him. It might be named for his son. There's Pitt the Elder and Pitt the Younger. This is William Pitt the Elder. And then a young, ambitious, and very talented and capable 26-year-old general named James Wolfe. And this is the, from a French perspective, I suppose, the unholy trinity that brought the downfall of France in North America. Now, let's go to the next illustration. Up until Pitt became prime minister, the British had a fairly rough go of it. Pitt was a remarkable man. We'll come back to him in another context a little later. One of his achievements and accomplishments was to design a battle strategy, or as it says here, Pitt strategy, that ultimately wound up working. In the southwestern region, they made a foray into the area. Fort Duquesne, a very French name, which now today is the city of Pittsburgh, named after, of course, William Pitt. Then up in the area of Nova Scotia, a number of engagements here, some naval, some land. But the heart in each war typically has a single most decisive battle. The French and Indian War was no exception. In this case, it took place in that city founded by Champlain, the man that I showed you a little bit earlier. Now, the city itself was Quebec, and you can see, if you're close enough, the date on which that battle occurred was September the 17th, 1759. No, it was not a holy day. Not everything seems to unfold on a holy day, but there is an interesting aspect to this, which those of us who believe that Israel is to be found among the Anglo-American peoples can point to. Now let's go on to the next illustration. Here is a, sharpen the focus a bit. There, thank you. Here is an inset map of the city of Quebec itself. And you can take a look at this. Quebec, the city, juts out into the St. Lawrence River in a way which made the city virtually impregnable. To look at it once again from the biblical perspective, it is like the city of Jericho that we read about in the book of Joshua. It is like the city of Jerusalem, a highly defensible city in the days of David. Now, for those of you who come at this from the angle of the Bible, probably quickly rushing to your mind is, yes, and what happened to those two cities? These invincible, impregnable, unassailable fortresses both fell. And the same was the case with the city of Quebec. There was a plain which overlooked the city in this region here. Now, Wolfe had been assigned to the area, and he knew if he could wind up taking Quebec, that the French effort, at least in the long run, would ultimately collapse. Within 4 years of this battle, indeed it did. Wolfe knew winter was coming on, and he was able to locate, and let's go now to the next illustration, a little trail that ascended to the plain overlooking the city. We'll go to the next illustration. You'll see one of those classic textbook photos of the British troops going up to the plainland. The plainland, and for those of you who are acquainted with Mr. Gerald Waterhouse in the Church of God matrix, this is the kind of thing that Mr. Waterhouse would make a great hay out of. The name of that plain is the Plain of Abraham. Now, I don't know if God purposefully hangs signs to remind us or cue us regarding certain things, but it is an interesting coincidence that the decisive battle of this Anglo-French war was, in essence, decided on a plain that bore the name of the man whose promises, in essence, were being fought over. Now, moving on to the next illustration. This English history is replete with examples like this. This is young James Wolfe. It's like Horatio Nelson, who we'll take a look at in a little later presentation tomorrow. Many of these generals wind up winning the battle, but they get themselves killed in the process. And Wolfe was not an exception to that. Wolfe wound up dying, but in the long run, Quebec was taken, and it was just marking time from that point forward until the greater part of North America would fall into the hands of the British. Next illustration. Now, I want you to take a look at the way things have changed. What a remarkable contrast. Thinking once again in terms of Reuben versus Joseph, you have the orange-shaded territory representing Spanish holdings. Here would be Spanish holdings after the peace settlement ending this worldwide conflict in 1763. Okay? Then the pink-shaded area shows you the vast stretches of territory that went from French into English hands. We are now around the midpoint in the 18th century. The only blue we see on the map is this little section down in the West Indies. And you might ask, why did the French choose to retain that instead of territory in North America? At that point in time, it was more profitable. They produced sugar, and ultimately rum was made out of a lot of that. And it was a more lucrative proposition for the French to hang on in that respect. Now, let's go to the next illustration. This was what it looked like only 63 years before. This is the earlier map that I showed you. But what I submit to you is that we are seeing a drastic setting of the stage as we move closer and closer to the turn of the 19th century. Who will be the inheritor of those promises that were passed on, the double portion, if you will, of the birthright? Will it be the first of the two firstborns, Reuben, whose ancestors would, in my judgment, be the French, or would it be the descendants of Joseph, of those Englishmen and those who settled as English colonials, most likely the descendants of Manasseh? Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now, we'll take you into a foray here of a little bit of history, which is imperial history. It happens to reflect on the history of the nation which I hail from. But what we are looking at here, I suggest, is Genesis 48 in fulfillment. When you look at Genesis 16 through 19, you read in verse 16 that the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh will grow up together and become a people, a large people, a great people. Now, in the back, you'll see volumes, Mr. McNair's from Global Church of God, Stephen Collins, who I believe is, he attends, I think, at United Church of God. Mr. Collins has done a mammoth work in terms of piecing together some of the history between the time that Israel disappears into the mists, as it were, whisked away into captivity by the Assyrians in the late 8th century BC, and then when the Anglo-Saxons, if you will, emerge virtually out of nowhere on the northwestern European coastal areas. Okay? Now, verse 19 of that same passage in Genesis 48 prophesies or predicts a time when there will be a decisive separation. Manasseh, the older of the two sons, upon whom the lesser blessing seems to be conferred, Manasseh, so said Jacob, will become a great nation. He also shall be great, is the wording in verse 19. As for the descendants of Ephraim, they will become a company, a multitude of nations, what we know today as the British Empire. If you were to have looked, and let's go one illustration forward, in the late 1700s, at the general trend in British imperial history, the American Revolution, or to put it in a British context, Melvin Rhodes, I know, was here within the last year or so. When I talk with Melvin, I talk about the revolt of the colonies. He doesn't understand what happened as the American Revolution. The revolt of the colonies goes against the entire grain of British imperial history. Why did it happen? I would suggest that it was a fulfillment of these prophecies, which go way back, all the way to the times of Ephraim and Manasseh in the forecast. Now, this is a classic American Revolutionary propaganda illustration. I'll show you some good old American propaganda here over the next few slides. But America did revolt in the long run. And let's go forward. Why did this happen? We see here one of the illustrations that comes out of an old Plain Truth magazine. And to me, it's a good way to illustrate the unfolding and the fulfillment of Genesis chapter 48. Here you see two puzzle pieces. Each bear the heraldic flag imagery that you would expect on the left of the United States of America and on the right of Great Britain. They would fit nicely together, wouldn't they? They're cut in such a way where they can come together and work nicely. Matter of fact, when you put them together, they actually become stronger. What the knitting together of the two to work together implies something. Margaret Thatcher made a comment, I believe it was when she was still prime minister. She said, in the 20th century, when Britain and America have acted together, they have dominated the world. When they have acted separately or at odds with one another, the world has dominated them. Now, I think that's a weighty observation. I also think it is bordering on a prophetic observation. I wonder, because of the truth of that proposition in the 20th century, where not only Britain, in terms of that little island group that sits off the rump of the continent of Europe, but as you well know from your own national history, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, and so on, when that has been thrown into the mix, we have been a formidable adversary to any who would challenge us. Will we come to a point in time where that will begin to fragment and break apart? Well, time will tell, but some of the prophecies relevant to the time of Jacob's trouble do not bode well, at least in my judgment. Now, the next illustration, we'll go back to some imagery. Once again, fairly familiar stuff for those of us who have read from time to time and over the years, Genesis 48. The crossing of Jacob's arms, the conferring of a certain blessing on these two sons, Ephraim on our left, Manasseh on our right. Why the separation? Now let's go to the next illustration and talk a little bit about some of the background which led to that. English settlement in 1700. Toeholds along the eastern seaboard of North America. Next illustration will show a little bit different version of this. By the time the revolution developed in 1775, the boundaries had extended a little bit further back. Again, we have in the United States, we have a mountain chain that runs just like the Blue Mountains here that separates us from the interior of the land. And the borders tended to conform to that mountain chain, at least in the early days. How many colonies do you count there? Well, there are 13. Let's talk about that for a moment. 13 in the Bible, as most or many anyway numbers do, 40 connotes judgment, 7 perfection. 13 has a connotation of corruption, of decay, of revolution, of decomposition and those types of things. Genesis chapter 14 and verse 4, in fact, is the first instance where the number 13 is mentioned in Scripture. And if you read that, guess what it describes? It is describing a rebellion of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and their allies against the king of Elam. In North America, the colonials, a group of 13 colonies, not very well knit together, at least in the onset, deigned to challenge the world's most powerful imperial nation. By this point, by the late 18th century, Britain dominated more so than any other nation throughout the world. They felt themselves capable of and justified in resisting the rule that was placed upon them. Now, let's go to the next illustration. How do you get there from here? Well, some of the backdrop or background goes into the management of the colonies themselves. This rather rotund figure that you see here, and you may have seen him in a history textbook along the way, is a fellow named Robert Walpole. He is probably the man most deserving of the title Prime Minister before any others in the story of English history. For over two decades, he served in that role. Now, respecting the colonies, Walpole developed a certain administrative style. He called it salutary or benevolent neglect. By that, he meant that you shouldn't try to enforce rules that you cannot enforce. Now, if any of you have had children, it plays out in a way similar to the way that it operates in the nuclear family. Let's say a mom and a dad, around the time their children turn 16 or 17 years old, suddenly decide, we've never had any real rules in this family. We want our children now to start coming in at 5:30 in the evening. We would like them to leave a 5-page, single-spaced, typewritten report of all their day's activities. They are utterly and completely accountable to us for everything they do. How does that play in the provinces? Well, it doesn't play very well. Walpole's adage for colonial management was, let sleeping dogs lie. In the United States, and perhaps here in Australia, we have a similar phrase that's a bit more modern. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Okay? Everything went fairly well through the early 1700s until, and let's now go to the next illustration, the entry of a young and somewhat ambitious monarch. His name was George III, and as I've already told you, in American history textbooks, we don't have a lot nice to say about George. Point of fact, George wasn't all that bad of a guy. In his defense, I will say, of the House of Windsor, he seems to be one of the few who has been able to, who was able to maintain fidelity in marriage. I think he had about 14 children to prove that, by the way. George came to the throne behind a grandfather and a great-grandfather, George I and George II, both of whom had, in essence, turned power over into the hands of the prime minister. George I was actually the Prince of Hanover, and again, in one of those transitions in English royal life where, the drive was to make sure that a Protestant rather than a Catholic ascended to the English throne. When Queen Anne died, a scramble ensued to try to find the next closest Protestant successor to the English throne. George I of Hanover was awakened in the middle of the night, informed that he had just been made King of England. He grunted, rolled over, and went back to sleep. George was so enamored with the idea of being king over England that he never bothered to learn to speak the English language. Now, what that did in terms of English politics is it created a power vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum. When there is a vacuum in power, it is inevitable that something will rush in to fill that vacuum. In this case, parliamentary government by the prime minister, received an enormous boost through two generations of English monarchs, George I and then his successor, George II. George III was a different figure. George fancied himself born not just to reign, which in many ways is what Queen Elizabeth II does today. She reigns England, but in terms of ruling, having a direct hands-on involvement in the politics or the political life of the country. That's not done today. In the 1760s, George ascended the throne in the year 1760, he was probably well within his rights to try to do this. The evolution of parliamentary style government, more democratic government, would take some time through the history of the Anglo-American peoples. The Americans, as we'll see in a moment, were about to give it a major push forward. But good old King George insisted on ruling, having hands on, controlling things. And as a result, he alienated not only a lot of people in England, including William Pitt, who we'll come back to in a moment or two, but also, and maybe especially, the colonials in North America. They took great offense to someone who now wanted a more direct involvement in their colonial affairs. Now, surrounding George, and we'll go to the next illustration, was a host of individuals. One example would be the man, again, another rotund figure in 18th century British history, whose name was Lord North. George had many prime ministers, none of whom seemed to be capable of fulfilling the job or the role. And North, I forget exactly when it was probably somewhere in the 1770s, North ascended to the job or the responsibility, 1770, I see I've noted here. He became prime minister. Now, I don't know if you have this expression of speech in Australia, but in the United States, we have what we call yes men. Do you know what that means? Okay, all right, good. Lord North was not a yes man. He was a yes sir, three bags full man. Okay? Whatever the king wished to be done, that, oh, sire, you are the wisest and mightiest in all the land. Problem is that, well, to put it again in maybe an American term, George III was not the sharpest knife in the Windsor drawer. Okay? He was not prone to always make the right decision. In fact, if you really look at it honestly, I think more often than not, he was instinctively drawn to the wrong decisions. He was surrounded by not only North, but many other people, and I'll speak to this a little later in these presentations, by many others who were there to do the king's bidding, not to try to keep the king from running the country aground. Now, next illustration. This emblematic figure, this is a period illustration from the 1770s. It's called the Excise Man, and it was done to parody the situation in England after this French and Indian War that I talked to you about. Nobody likes taxes. Do you here in Australia like to be taxed? No, we don't in North America. Well, our whole nation arose out of a controversy over taxation. In England, when they fought the French and Indian War, and then on the continent, the Seven Years' War, and they also had the theater of operations in India, which drove the French out of India and established India as a major British or English province. During that time, the national debt in England essentially doubled. And parliamentarians looked at one another and said, as you and I would at the level of the individual, how are we going to pay for all of this? And the answer was, let's raise taxes. So in England, they began to put taxes on all sorts of things. And you can see some of the examples, cider and various other items that are illustrated. In the lower right-hand corner, you have a window. And I forget, I think it was Mr. Shaw and I were talking about this the other night as we went up around the Sydney Harbour Bridge. We think in terms of American and British and, Anglo-American great economic greatness. Part of the reason that we are great economically is because we happen to be the first to discover or to come upon that Promethean fire of the industrialization process. Now, when you think of early industrialization, you think oftentimes of sweatshops. Why were those conditions primitive? Well, in part, around the late 1700s, about the same time the Industrial Revolution began to really bloom and flower, there was a law passed against, taxing windows. And the captains of industry, being the philanthropic fellows that they were, you can imagine how many windows went into the industrial sweatshops. Okay? It contributed a lot to the grief of the working class in those early days of industrialization. Next illustration. Another thing that had been brought on by the war is that England's supply bill had risen about tenfold. And here you have a satirical cartoon, a period print, of Mother Britannia with L'Enfant, baby George III, in arms. And if you can read the caption, he's saying, "More supplies." It's almost like Oliver Twist, you know, "May I have another, sir," at the meal table. How do you pay for those bills? Well, let's go to the next slide, and you'll see a symbol which tells a part of that story. In 1765, 2 years after the war was finally settled, you had the introduction of the Stamp Act. And this emblem was affixed to all kinds of public documents and newspapers and legal documents and what have you. The Americans, who had really never been taxed before, were absolutely scandalized. The colonials could not understand this. Now, in point of fact, let me shed some British perspective on it all. The tax that was introduced in North America amounted to about 1/25 of the tax that ordinary citizens residing in the British Isles typically paid. And I don't know about you, but if someone came to me and said, "I'm going to reduce your taxes by 24/25, I would say, "Where do I sign?" But it's all in perspective. And Vivian and I were talking about this, I think, yesterday or day before. People tend to be upset when they have certain privileges or rights, and then they're taken away. Well, the American colonials had freedom from taxation. Now suddenly they find themselves put upon with taxes. Next illustration. This was the measured and gentle response that you got in North America. Okay, the tax collector is tarred and feathered. He's forced to drink tea. I've noticed that you folks drink coffee over here a lot more than what I would have thought. I don't know, maybe you Australians and we Americans have more in common than I thought. But there's an aversion even still today in many quarters in America to drinking tea. In Texas, when we do, we put ice in it, which I know sounds horrible down here. But the resistance to this was vehement. In the background, you see an allusion to another landmark event, and we'll talk about that momentarily, where a bunch of colonials dumped tea into the Boston Harbor. Now, let's go forward one more illustration. Now, this handsome rascal that you see here, do you guys get Rush Limbaugh down here? Okay, so he's probably more an American figure. This man is named John Wilkes. John Wilkes is an interesting figure in late 18th century British history, because he was, and if you could see the entire placard, which I wasn't able to get in out of the illustration, the placard reads "Liberty." In England, he was an incorrigible enemy of George III. He wrote many essays that were published, and George got so mad that Wilkes actually fled the country on a couple of occasions. The Americans, who were concerned with liberty, seized upon John Wilkes and made him their champion. Now, I put his image here in this presentation at this point to make a point. There were those in England who knew what the problem was, who could have preserved the empire. There were those who had the wisdom, the balance, the measured approach, and knew what judgments were called for, but none of those men were within the circle of decision makers who called the shots. Once again, I refer you to Daniel chapter 4. God places people in positions of power and authority to yield the product or the ends which he wants to produce. Next illustration would be another classic figure in that context. His name was Edmund Burke. He was Anglo-Irish. He was one of the most gifted orators of that particular historical period. And he's a little bit like the Apostle Paul in terms of his counsel or advice. Paul, in the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 6 and verse 12, makes the observation, and I'll put it in a paraphrase way, "You know, you can do might near anything you'd like to do, but some things that you might be able to do are really stupid." Now, the scripture, in essence, says all things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. Burke appealed vigorously to George III and the powers that be, "Don't push these colonials." Next illustration is one of the classic cartoons of the period. The late 18th century in the English world was a heyday, a period for political cartooning. And this is one of the great, imperial illustrations, which helps us realize that there were some people that understood what was about to unfold. Lord North, in his grandeur, sitting in front, surrounded by various members of Parliament, they have the goose that lays the golden egg. Okay? And they evidently have reached the decision that it's dinner time and they would like a good goose dinner. Now, they may kill the goose, and that goose may be the best tasting goose. It may be the best goose dinner that's ever been made. But the problem is you see the basket with all those eggs in the upper left-hand corner. Once that head comes off, no more eggs. Now, again, I'll preach at you for a moment. We can do that in our personal lives as well. I've been there. I've done that. Okay, you can technically be in the right, but wind up not serving your best interest. Now, in a subtle and brilliant touch in the upper portion of the cartoon, you have, once again, that quintessential symbol of Britain, the lion. And he's fast asleep, basking in the sun. Now, the message is a telling one, isn't it? Now, another illustration along these lines, next illustration, two ways to milk a cow is the rough translation of this illustration. Upper left-hand corner, you've got the milkmaids, and you've got the various ones who are trying to get a bucket of milk. They're beating the cow, they're hitting it, they're actually even bleeding it on toward the backside. And you can see that the poor fellow who's trying to milk it has had the bucket kicked over and has lost what little milk he's been able to extract. That's one way to milk a cow. On the other hand, in the right foreground, you can drape the cow with a laurel wreath. You can feed it. You can stroke it. You can probably say nice things to it while the little milkmaid is pumping for all she's worth down at the other end. The message here characterizes well the thought of Burke and many others in late 18th century British society. Don't provoke people to the point that they are going to break and run. You can make this worse than it has to be. Next illustration, we will go again back to the Honorable William Pitt the Elder. Brilliant orator as well, a man who people would come to listen to, even if they disagreed with him, because what he said so well. A remarkable man. Pitt justifiably viewed himself as the father of the British Empire in North America. And William Pitt was very much averse to seeing foolish political policy bring an end to what his, well, let's call it what it was, political genius had helped to construct. I would say as a historian that probably if anyone could have saved the circumstance or reversed the tide of history, or should we say prophecy, this would have been the man who would have been able to do it. Problem is that in the spring of 1775, William Pitt had, well, something that he had had difficulty with throughout the more recent time in his life. He experienced recurring fits of insanity. And in the spring of 1775, which was the same season of the year when the American Revolution began, William Pitt lapsed into a two-year period of disability, retired, if I recall right, to the country, convalesced, and by the time he returned in the spring of 1777, it was too late to roll back an inevitable tide of history. He did come back, and next illustration will show, in 1777, on the floor of Parliament, in the midst of an impassioned speech, trying to stall or reverse American independence, Pitt collapsed, and within about a year, he wound up dead, removing from the scene probably the person best able to reverse the tide in what seemed to be progressive expansion of the British Empire. Was that happenstance? Was it accident? Again, my mind turns to Daniel chapter 4. Now, next illustration, there were a number of things that were a prelude to the ultimate rupture in relations. In 1767, the British again put a number of taxes on the American colonials. You find this illustration of what happened in September 30th, 1768. The colonials had resisted. They had attempted to create their own means of manufacturing goods. They boycotted British products and the like. And on the fifth day of the Feast of Tabernacles in 1768, the British showed up unannounced. A fleet pulled into Boston Harbor and troops began to debark, and they deployed on the village green. The city center, I guess, would be roughly analogous to what it would be in this part of the world. And they began to take up residence without permission in various people's houses and so on. And you can imagine the impact that that made. One thing led to another, and if we can go to the next illustration, in the city of Boston, once again, art is a great vehicle for propaganda. This is the so-called Boston Massacre. Five Americans were shot dead in a Boston street, and it almost has an Isaiah 53 quality, doesn't it? The poor, docile, peace-loving Americans who wouldn't hurt a fly. Some of you know Americans, huh? They stand like sheep before the slaughter to be mowed down by the heartless, cruel British who have exacted all these unrighteous indignities on the American people. Next slide will show you a little bit more appropriate illustration of what led to this. Throughout the day, the Americans, the less cultured element of Boston society, I would add, had been throwing snowballs, calling names, provoking the British soldiers, and probably some young soldier lost his temper and began firing, and before you knew it, five people were dead. What it did for the American cause of those who wished to have independence is it gave them an incident to celebrate. And it was part, once again, of this snowballing momentum which was going to break apart, I would submit to you, in fulfillment of Genesis 48, the two houses, or the two branches, pardon me, of the house of Joseph. Next illustration, to carry it a step further. This is obviously an American perspective. The American Indian, being held down by one parliamentarian, forced to drink tea by another, violated by yet another, holding her down in the bottom left, while Mother Britannia, with head in hand, seems to be saying, can't you guys figure out how to do this right? You know, you have a vast treasure trove at your fingertips, and you're about to lose it. Next illustration. Tea, of course, as I've already mentioned, was a central issue. This is one of those classic illustrations of the exploding teapot, I think was the name of it. And it was around the issue of tea that these things developed. Now, American historians have come to the conclusion, most textbooks bear this out nowadays, that these events were the result not over issues of tea or even money, but the central question driving the American Revolution is what it is in so many areas of human conflict. Who is in charge? That's really what seems to be the bedrock. Is there parliamentary supremacy, or do the colonials act with some measure and degree of independence? And the tea issue is a classic example illustrating this. British East India Company, not too far from this area of the world, got itself in trouble. There was a glut of tea on the world market, and they began to lose a lot of money. They couldn't unload their tea. So the parliamentarians in Britain sat down and designed a plan to cut out all the middlemen, including American retailers. They would take East Indiamen loaded with tea, sail to North America, and then sell their tea directly to the consumer. It was a brilliant economic plan. Everybody wins. East India Company now sells more tea, and the price of tea falls for the American consumer. Everyone's happy. Right? No. The issue, once again, is who is in charge. And in this instance, the American colonials interpreted this as a crafty, manipulative move in order to exercise parliamentary control. Next illustration. Once again, you have some of Boston's finer citizens, like this man, Samuel Adams, who today would be a candidate for the psychiatric ward. Good old Sam had a lot of personal problems, and he worked it out in his anger against George III, and really was one of the rabble-rousers who did much to inflame the situation beyond the point of no return. Adams stirred up things such as, next illustration, one of the great episodes in American history, the Boston Tea Party, in which about 75,000 American dollars of tea was tossed into Boston Harbor. And you know what? The British didn't find that funny. Well, if I had been in England, I think I probably would have been sympathetic. A group of some of the less cultured elements, we'll say, of Boston, dressed up, thinly disguised as Mohawk Indians, went up aboard these ships and broke open the cargo and tossed it into the harbor. Next illustration. Meanwhile, the cultured elements of Boston society stood on the docks and cheered. Okay? Interesting commentary on social relations, I suppose, of that day and age. Britain reacted with classic overreaction, I guess I could say. There's a historian, Barbara Tuchman, who has written a lot. She's a very delightful historian. She's no longer living. But she wrote a book called March of Folly, and some of you may have read it. It's a very nicely done historical piece showing many examples through history, modern and ancient, of how people in charge have acted against their own best self-interest by doing things they did not have to do, which wound up really doing great damage in the long run to what would have served them best. The term that she used is a very high-powered academic term, very sophisticated language. It's wooden-headedness. Okay? I'm joking, of course, about the sophistication. About this incident, or not this incident, but about the British response, Barbara Tuchman made the observation, wooden-headedness knew no finer hour. The British shut down Boston Harbor, forbid public assemblies, and demanded that until every last pound of tea, pound meaning the British monetary unit, had been paid for, Boston Harbor would remain closed. Now, hold on a moment. I'm not all that smart, but even I can figure out when a lot of the city's income is generated from trade going in and out of that harbor and you shut it down, it's going to be a long time before you're able to pay that money back. Now, again, this is writ large among the nations what we do as individuals with reckless abandon in our personal lives. You know, one thing leads to another, and before you know it, you've destroyed a human relationship. Next illustration. Moving forward, the colonials, both uncultured and cultured, eventually enough of them came to the conclusion that conflict was going to break out. And if you've ever heard of Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, a much celebrated episode in American history, there's a Longfellow poem, "Listen, My Children, and You Shall Hear of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere." Next illustration. How did Paul see where he was going when he rode? Whoops. All right, let's go on to the next. I think we got one more. There we go. That was one out of sequence. My apologies. How did Paul see where he was going as he rode down the road to warn the American militiamen that the British were about to march up from Boston to where the Americans had been stockpiling ammunition and weapons? Well, for those, again, in our tradition, it probably will make considerable sense. It was on April 18th, 1775, and it was the fifth day of unleavened bread. Now, why is that significant? Well, God's holy day dates, at least the beginning of the spring and the fall holy day seasons, begin with a big full moon. And even by the fifth day of unleavened bread, you still have a fairly sizable moon to illuminate the way that you would go. Now, what I'm saying here is we have then beginning a 40-year period from 1775 to 1815, when I think even those viewing this from a secular historical perspective would have to agree this is a pivot point in world history. Within that 40-year time frame, the events which develop and take place ensconce in power the Anglo-American people, and by extension, the 19th and 20th centuries have become Anglo-American centuries. They even call the 19th century the British century. It was typical to make the statement, "God is an Englishman," in the 19th century. I'm not sure what God's nationality is, but if you looked in the 19th century, it certainly seemed to be the case. In the midst of the days of unleavened bread, the American Revolution began, and 40 years and a few months later, on the fields of Waterloo, on the day of Pentecost, that 40-year process came to closure when Napoleon was defeated. The two brothers, Reuben and Joseph, had worked through the dynamics of seeing which brother would inherit the double portion of that birthright. Now, meanwhile, back in Boston. Next illustration. Three writers warned of the coming British troops, and different ones went these different routes. The British Army marched that night a fairly lengthy distance for that day and age up to the city of Lexington, and then ultimately they went on to Concord. Now, in Lexington, let's go to the next illustration. Pitcairn and his group met with a group of American Minutemen, militiamen, and Pitcairn ordered them to disperse, which they refused to do. Someone, we don't know who, fired a shot, next illustration, and the rebel troops broke, as you can see here, and ran, retreating up the road toward Concord. The British moved in hot pursuit. Let's go to the next illustration. They arrived in Concord, these folks being up all night long on a forced march. They were worn, they were tired. They were also, I might add, the best among the best troops in the British Empire. Some had fought in India, some had fought in North America, some had fought in Europe, and some had fought in several of those places, if not all. But funny things happen when you're tired, and funny things happen when people don't play according to the rules. Is Bill Cosby a figure known here in Australia? Okay. Bill Cosby put it in a way about 30 years ago, and I'll use his example. He said, now what if in history we did things like we do in football games? I've got a coin with Elizabeth's image on it here. What if you call the captain of the British and the captain of the colonials together and you flip that coin, the Americans called it, and they win? The referee confers and he talks to the Americans and then turns to the British and said, all right, Americans win, colonials win. They say they're going to wear any color of clothing they want to. They're going to shoot from behind rocks and trees and everywhere. And your team must wear red and march in a straight line. Now, that was the challenge that the British were up against. Wearing red, as you can see here, and fighting by conventional 18th century European rules. The Americans, well, they were old squirrel hunters. They were like, when I was a child, you have rabbits here, I know, because someone brought them over here and they've created problems for you ever since. You needed my grandfather here. My grandfather, Walter Little, when I was a youngster, would take me with him when he went to, we had pests in our area that were rabbits as well, and he would try to kill them off about every month or two. He'd go out and shoot them. And he would send me to fetch them. And I would go pick them up. Until I was about 8 years old, I thought a rabbit only had one eye. He would not shoot until he got a clear shot, and it would knock that one eye all the way through. And the one eye it did have bulged out about 3 inches on the other side of the head. Now, my grandfather was in the tradition of these early American colonials. They could shoot squirrels out of a tree from 200 yards. They were excellent marksmen, and they were an enigma to the British, who were used to fighting more conventional style warfare. Next illustration. Let me begin to move to closure here because we're almost out of time. There's an interesting disjuncture between Lexington and Concord, which was in April of 1775, next illustration, and the Declaration of Independence. America did not formally break, next illustration, by signing the document you see here until July 4th, 1776. What that says to me is this was a solution, this was a situation that could have been solved. Now, next illustration. This, folks, is the first flag raised by the American colonists in battle against the British. What's wrong with that picture? Now, if you talk about cognitive dissonance, ambiguity. The stripes connoted rebellion, but in the upper left-hand corner you have the classic heraldic flag representation of the British, or the English. Next illustration. This clergyman is a fellow named John Wesley, and we'll wrap up with some comments on John Wesley. John Wesley was a man who worked both sides of the Atlantic. He was a Methodist clergyman, and Wesley knew what circumstances were like both in England and in North America. Wesley wrote a letter appealing to George III to cease and desist, to stop those behaviors that were alienating his American subjects. Otherwise, the empire in North America would be lost. And he concluded that letter with a very interesting and compelling appeal. He wrote, "For God's sake, remember Rehoboam." Now, who is Rehoboam? Let's see. He was a Davidic monarch who became alienated from his Israelitish subjects of the northern kingdom. What was the issue? Oh, yeah, taxes. Interesting echo across the times and the bounds of history. I will conclude with that for today, and for those of you who are interested in hearing the good stuff, as Mr. White put it, if you would like to come back tomorrow, again, we'll be up and running about 11 o'clock, and then again, we'll have another afternoon session, and we'll begin to fill in more flesh on the bones of the skeleton that I've tried to sketch here today.
Thank you, Dr. Sherrod. I'd just like to thank both of our speakers this afternoon. And as he said, he really set the stage for the remainder of the lectures for tomorrow. So we'd heartily invite you to come back tomorrow. Just a reminder, we have tea and coffee up the back, and also you're very welcome to socialize with us in the room next door after 5 o'clock. So thank you for coming, and drive home safely. Thank you.